From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, test scores paint a discouraging picture of the state of public education in Michigan.
Whether it's third grade math or eighth grade reading, whether it's for white students, black students, brown students, we are now in the bottom five states.
Congress reveals Russian trolls meddled not only in the presidential election, but also Enbridge Line 5 oil pipeline.
It certainly raises legitimate questions about to what degree we're going to allow this to go on in our social discourse.
We talk with a new young community leader from Flint.
We want to not only do what's best for our community, but if we can, serve as a model for other communities, knowing that poverty isn't unique to Flint, and nobody's cornered the market on how you respond.
Plus, do violent video games spark real-life violent behavior? Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan has pumped nearly $80 million into boosting third grade reading levels. But the latest analysis from the Education Trust Midwest shows, despite all that spending, early reading scores in our state went down. Third graders in Michigan at the bottom of the country in their test scores. In fact, we're one of the few states actually losing ground in those critical third grade reading levels. Amber Arellano is Executive Director of the Education Trust Midwest. Amber, welcome back.
Thank you.
So the 2018 State of Michigan Education Report is called Top 10 for Education, Not by Chance. An interesting choice of title. What's behind that phrasing?
Our report now is really trying to take a deeper look at how we do our work in Michigan, because what we've learned from leading states around the country is that it's not just about putting more money into the system to improve it. It's also about becoming more effective. It's about investing more in the things that actually are really proven to work, research-based strategies that actually move the ball and change classroom practices. In Michigan, we think a lot about all the things that change schools or think about schools sort of on the outside of the box of the school. In other words, we have arguments about competition and charter schools and governance, but all of those things don't actually reach into what happens in the school building. And that's actually where things really happen for students, right? That's where teaching and learning happens. And so it's called Not by Chance because the way that Michigan goes about its work is that we just sort of have this patchwork approach to our strategies and our spending. We really do leave it to chance of whether or not kids in classrooms are getting the best reading instruction than they can. And we just don't know. We don't even have data to look at that right now because it's such a crapshoot.
So I'm quoting from the new report. Here is the quote. Michigan's public education system is among the poorest performing in the country. What do the numbers tell us?
So for every indicator that we have available tells us about teaching and learning, whether it's third grade math or eighth grade reading, whether it's for white students, black students, brown students, we are now in the bottom five states. A lot of folks thought that maybe we had hit bottom. This has been a trend that's been going on since the early 2000s. We thought that we had hit bottom several years ago. And what the new data are telling us that we just haven't hit bottom yet. You know, we've actually lost ground over the last 3 years on the M-STEP. That's a really important indicator because this is our first state assessment in history that allows us to compare to other states involved in the same assessment consortium. What the data suggests is that we don't know that we've hit bottom yet. And so it's a really sobering reality.
Nobody should think not our district.
That's right. I mean, we looked at every group of students, Latino, immigrant, white students, higher income students, lower income students. Everyone has declined on third grade reading. And what's so alarming about that is that this is one of the most important indicators of how well students are going to learn through their K-12 experience, how likely they are to go to college or get some sort of post-secondary training. If you don't read well, you can't learn all the other subjects. And it's even an important indicator of lifelong employment for job success and earnings. So if there's a place for us to start, it's here.
So let's talk about those early reading scores. I know the first year M-STEP was administered was in 2014, 2015. At that point, 50% of third graders tested as proficient in reading skills. So the state puts the money in, says we're going to pass a law that kicks in a couple years saying we're going to hold kids back who are a full grade behind. So for that $80 million and the talk, where are we now?
So we are now one of the few states in the country that have continued to decline over the last few years. In fact, we showed the greatest decline, which is actually shocking given that we're working so hard on it. You know, I have a daughter in kindergarten, and we are having ongoing conversations with the teacher about how we can help support her. We have a tutor. You know, the school is dialed in on this. It's not that folks in the field are not working really hard. There's great urgency. It's just that it's how we're doing it. The way that Michigan is spending that $80 million is the state's essentially saying, we're going to cut these checks to local ISDs. We're not going to have real prescription or guidance or any accountability around the dollars. We're not going to collect data on how they're using that.
Here's money.
Right. Here's the money. Good luck. Hope it goes well. We're not even checking to see like what the practice looks like. If they're doing coaching, like what does that look like? How do we know that that's really effective? How do we know that that's actually really helping teachers and kids get better? In a state like Tennessee, for example, it looks so vastly different. The state has built these really amazing systems of coaching and improvement for teachers and principals in particular. They look to see who are the teachers in our state that are the most effective and that are getting the biggest gains in teaching for kids. Let's see if those folks are interested in taking on additional responsibilities for additional pay, working through summers to help retrain teachers, to help support teachers. And then now you have this sort of standing Marine Corps of the best teachers in the state. They're able to support teachers and principals around the state on what best practice looks like. That is radically different than what we're doing. And that's why it's such a crapshoot. It's hard to learn how to get better when you're not even taking a close look at what your practice looks like around the state. And so, you know, what we're doing is just not working. It's about getting smarter about the how.
Knowing that it was 50% that first year, and now looking at your report, I see 44% of third graders. And knowing that in 2 years, the state can start holding third graders back, what do you think we're in for?
I don't necessarily think it was the wrong move for the legislature to make it a priority. I think that was a good thing, and I think it really truly has created this great urgency and a focal point for a system that's muddling at best right now. The challenge, though, is that because of weak implementation, you combine that with retention. We're talking about what could be the majority of kids in the state, and certainly in urban areas and rural areas, you know, we're talking about almost all of the kids of color in the state being held back. And that's not their fault. And it's not necessarily the educators in the school's fault either. It's just that we're not properly supporting and building the internal capacity of schools to actually become more effective.
And whose fault is that?
I think it's about leadership. It starts from the top down.
Are you talking about in the school district, in the school itself, in Lansing?
I think it starts in Lansing. If you look at leading education states, it starts with the governor. It starts with the top K-12 leaders in the state. In our state, that means our state superintendent in the Michigan Department of Education. And it starts by taking a really close and humble look at how our systems are set up. You know, what are our sort of feedback loops? How are we learning? How are we getting better? Are we doing what we know really works in the top states in the country and what research tell us? And right now, that answer is a resounding no.
Knowing that things are working in other states and scores have gone up and people are improving.
Dramatically, yeah.
Within your latest report, you do look at some work being done in collaboration with Grand Rapids Public Schools and Wyoming Public Schools in some high poverty schools where there is kind of an encouraging story to tell.
Yeah, I think we need to take a look at the places where they really are making gains. The whole state is not going down. There are places for hope. The Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning and the Steelcase Foundation have been partnering with Wyoming and Grand Rapids Public Schools. They're working side by side, those principals and teachers, to look at their practices and look at, see, what school level systems do we need to build better to support educators and classrooms to become more effective? What does that look like? This is actually, in many ways, sort of a pilot of taking some of those models that have been so hugely successful in the state of Tennessee, bringing them that back here, and seeing if they can work in high-poverty schools in Michigan, and they're working. So, I mean, it shows that our kids are not somehow innately inferior to kids in other states. These are some of very poor neighborhoods in districts that are often under-resourced, but the district leadership in those places and the school leadership and the teachers in those schools, they are doing such great and really hard work. They've been at it now for several years, and we can learn a lot from that place.
You know, Amber, you and the team at Education Trust Midwest, you keep crunching the data. You keep doing these studies like this latest one, the top 10 education, not by chance. And the message seems to be pretty unchanging. Mixed Michigan students are losing ground to the rest of the country. Do you ever get discouraged? Do you ever feel like the proverbial voice crying in the wilderness?
I used to, but, you know, I think what's happened is that more and more organizations have been really changing. I mean, they've been really committing and saying, you know, we are not going to sit by the sidelines and hope that this is going to work out. I think you're going to see more organizations coming out in the next month or two. I think there's going to be probably one of the top topics at the Mackinac Policy Conference this year. I think it's incumbent on all of us to make sure that the gubernatorial candidates this year and this fall are making public education a top priority. And I hope that people will join us in insisting on that. We have a website, michiganachieves.org, where people can sign up. They can find ways to get active and they can find ways to be a voice in making sure that this just doesn't get lost in all the other political baits and all the other priorities right in front of us. I mean, we have really kicked the can on public education for a long time. And I think for a long time, it made sense. The state was in the Great Recession. It was a devastating time. People were losing jobs. I mean, you know, there was just so much on the table, just like people were like, I'm just trying to save my house. You know, I don't have the capacity right now to figure out.
No bandwidth.
Right. And there just wasn't. There wasn't at the state level. There wasn't locally. But we are well beyond that now. And if the loss of the Amazon, of having a chance of bringing those jobs to Michigan, and that was one of the most important pieces of feedback that Amazon said, you don't have a good talent pipeline. You're among the worst in the country. That's not where we want to be. We can't find highly skilled workers from a K-12 system that is in the bottom of the country. We're 49th for many indicators now. So this is a moment of, I think, of great awakening. I think we're going to see many more organizations stepping up and saying, we are in this. We are going to make this a priority. We are going to insist that our state leaders make this a priority.
Amber Arellano is the Executive Director of the Education Trust Midwest. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come. Social media accounts linked to Russian propagandists, troll farms, were tweeting and posting about Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac. That's according to a congressional report. We're going to hear more in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time now to check out West Michigan's music scene as we say hello again to John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com, the website that covers West Michigan's music scene. John, we're going to start out with a far-out supergroup called Earth Radio. Tell us about this group.
Yeah, I decided that today I was going to grab a brand new group that's new to the West Michigan music scene, one that's been around for several years touring the country, and a third one that is legendary and has 40 years essentially of music under his belt. But Earth Radio is the new band. They describe themselves as kind of very experimental. They meld jazz and neo-soul and hip-hop and even some metal and rock into what they do. It's really interesting because when they got together, they knew from the get-go that this was going to be an interesting project. Singer and keyboard player Hannah Lane is sort of the fronting thing with in terms of her singing and her songwriting, but all of the members of the band write music, and they all come from different spots. They all come from different areas, whether it's funk or whether it's jazz. Bassist singer Justin Avdek is well known in the area. Mario Copeland plays drums. Keyboard player Dutcher Snedeker is very well known in terms of his jazz keyboard playing, and then guitarist Travis Swanson came down and joined the band after moving here from the Upper Peninsula. And it's interesting, they recorded this album in a log cabin in a Muskegon home. It turned out to be Justin Avdek's parents' house, and it turned out great. They really have an unusual, very distinctive sound. I don't think there's any other band in West Michigan that sounds quite like them.
Well, in fact, you use terms I have never seen you use before as you describe their songs, and I'm quoting you, interplanetary and multi-galactic.
Yeah, and organic as well, because a lot of the stuff that they do just sort of comes together on the fly. They wrote like 10 songs in a week and a half.
Let's take a listen to a track called Mall Walkin'. This is Earth Radio. It's time. is this group playing live anywhere? Because with all of this interesting background, I'm sure live would be a blast.
Yeah, they have plans. Right now there's nothing specific booked for them, but they definitely have plans, and they've gotten popular very quickly. Their CD release show last week was jam-packed, and I know that they're going to be performing certainly later this year.
All right, you can keep us up to date on that at localspins.com. Now we head over to a singer-songwriter who grew up in the Grand Rapids area but has made the move to Nashville.
Yeah, I've known Nathan Kalish pretty much from the beginning of his career. Growing up in this area, he really started his music career here. He had a band called The Wildfire. And when he first started out, I really kind of described his music more like in the rock realm, very similar to The Replacements, I thought. But he has really shifted gears over the years and become more and more interested in pushing the country envelope and Americana. It's got that psychedelic folk and rock edge to it as well, but he's really toured the country incessantly. He's already played 40 gigs on the road this year alone, and it's just early March, but he usually does, 200 gigs a year or more. He comes back to Michigan fairly regularly. I think he calls Nashville home just to call someplace home because, frankly, his life is always on the road.
Let's take a listen now. Nathan Kalish's new album is I Want to Believe, and here's a duet with singer Christy Hayes. This track is Do You Ever. That is a great sound, and you're saying it's kind of psychedelic and folk and rock and roll kind of all wrapped up.
Yeah, and it's really, a lot of this stuff is written on the road, and a lot of these songs are really about being on the road. He has a song called Bar Fight, which is about a singing bar fly. He wrote another song that after an extended week at Bike Week in Sturgis, he would say that the songs are full of introspection, dark humor, science fiction, and societal commentary. And frankly, it's all about the joys and frustrations of a touring musician, who's on the road pretty much all year long. He'll be back here in Michigan pretty quickly here. Otis Supply on March 12th in Ferndale, Creston Brewery in Grand Rapids on March 15th, and Speakeasy Lounge in Grand Rapids when he comes back through Michigan on June 13th.
And now we turn to, I guess the word venerable could apply here, somebody who has been making great music for some 40 years, Kalamazoo singer-songwriter Joel Maybes. What a body of work, right?
He is an amazing legend, essentially, in Michigan folk scene. He was actually at the Fretboard Festival this past weekend. I had a chance to chat with him a little bit and watch him play. He was doing a workshop. He's definitely been a mentor to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of musicians over the years. Ukulele Crimes is his 26th solo album, so he's been around for a while. And he also plays a lot of instruments, guitar, slide guitar, banjo, mandolin, fiddle, auto harp. But he really concentrated on his latest album, purely on the ukulele, an instrument that he's been playing since he was a little kid. And a lot of this is some lesser played vintage songs as well as some of his original material. And he says that it's all about escape and romance, as he put it, in an age of despair, played to the tune of a cheeky ukulele. And of course, it does add a very fun sound to everything that you play. I think it's impossible to play the ukulele without a smile at some point.
I love that term, the cheeky ukulele. And what is not to love about a guy who asks, is it a crime to play my ukulele when all the world is blue? Let's take a listen to Ukulele Crimes.
Now we got maniacs at large. We got lunatics in charge. We got politics of fear and greed. People shouting in the street. People stomping with their feet. Satisfaction is what they need. Now this world's in lots of trouble. Unless you're living in a bubble, you can read it on every face. But I'm not here to bring a grudge. I stand before you as my judge. So listen as I plead my sorry case.
So So is Joel going to be touring? You said you saw him last weekend. Is he going to be touring in Michigan to support this new album?
You can go to his website, joelmavis.com. He is constantly playing, and he is playing with a lot of other people. The interesting thing about him is that he's a very approachable guy and a very down-to-earth fellow here from Southwest Michigan. And even watching him perform this past weekend on his ukulele was just a pure joy. And the fact is that he's taught a lot of people about hit that instrument as well as just folk music in general over the years. So it's a blessing to have him here in West Michigan.
So just to recap, singer-songwriter Joel Mavis and his cheeky ukulele with his latest album, Ukulele Crimes. Nathan Kalish grew up in Grand Rapids, now is in Nashville and on the road all over America. His new album is I Want to Believe, and the supergroup Earth Radio, their debut album, Earth Radio. You can learn more about these and all kinds of other artists with West Michigan roots by going to localspins.com, which is, as always, edited and published by my guest, John Sinkovich. John, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Have a wonderful March. We'll talk to you again in April.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Is it a crime to play the ukulele when all the world is blue? Is it a crime to strum a little something when the troubles keep a-coming at you two by two? Is it a sin to sing a sunny song when that sky comes tumbling down? If it's a crime to sing and play the ukulele, you'll have to run me out of town. Yes, sir, run me out of town. Come on and try it. Run me out of town.
This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Community Foundation of Greater Flint. It's a public charity created by and for the people of Genesee County. Its president and CEO is here with us now. Isaiah Oliver is the youngest leader this group's ever had, as well as the first African American and the first to be born and raised in Flint. Isaiah Oliver, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Isaiah, what do you see as the most important mission of your group, of the Community Foundation of Greater Flint?
The Community Foundation of Greater Flint is an opportunity for people from across our community, those who have both the time and talent to give resources and those who have the treasure to commit to great causes, to be engaged in the community in ways that they couldn't even imagine. The Community Foundation is a space or a place where you can be engaged at whatever level and in whatever way you like to be. So, excellent place, excellent space to be engaged.
Why did you say yes to leading the group? What do you believe you bring to this job and to this mission?
I think we all live our lives hoping for that intersection of preparation and opportunity. And for me, this was the perfect space, the perfect intersection. The core values that I live by are clearly aligned to that of the Community Foundation of Greater Flint. Being in a space that you love and being able to contribute everything you have to making it a better place. The Community Foundation of Greater Flint and the tens of thousands of donors that have committed to the mission of the Community Foundation of Greater Flint is a place where you can give your best. And I'm in a position where I can give my best to making the community that I love better. No better place to work. I like to tell people I have the best job in Genesee County.
And here you are. You are young. You are coming at this with fresh eyes, and you've got something like $245 million with which to work in this community. So I'm wondering, what are your priorities, and what do you see as Flint's greatest needs?
Yeah, with 10 to 20,000 unique donors, 475 or more funds at the Community Foundation of Greater Flint, many would say they were soup to nuts. But we have found through our strategic planning processes that happen about every 5 years that we've committed to very focused areas. Education is one, building community around Genesee County with a specific emphasis on Flint neighborhoods is another, and the last one is health. Over the last 5 years, we've taken a deep dive or a double down on early childhood education or the two-generation approach to family education through a literacy initiative or piece of work that we've been doing with health. We've done a lot of work around access to healthy food, pre and post water crisis, that has been a need, and then really looking at building out Flint neighborhoods and authentic community engagement in the process of building neighborhoods has been important for us. So while I think broadly health education and building up neighborhoods has been important. We've been doing a lot of focus work on deliverables that matter for our community in those spaces.
And to that point, looking at these past 10 months or so since you became president and CEO of the Community Foundation of Greater Flint, what are some of the things that you're most proud of that have come together in that time?
Amazing $2 million between Consumers Energy Foundation and the Flint Now, Tom and Holly Gores Foundation, focused on Flint, doing some work around the Flint Promise, committing to post-secondary access for Flint students who live in Flint is one of the amazing things that's happened. We're doing a lot of work with the Flint Child Health and Development Fund. Of the $18 million that was raised over 18 months, we have about $5 million, $4.9 million granted out to organizations from across our community to respond to the negative impacts of lead exposure for 0 to 6-year-olds. Those are things that we can highlight as amazing. Just Friday, we had a dinner, community dinner, where we thought that people from across the spectrum in Genesee County needed the opportunity to engage with one another and have authentic conversation with one another. We had that dinner down at 501 Bar and Grill, right here in downtown Flint, and over 140 people showed up just to get to know one another better and to grow our relationships across community. So we've been doing some very high touch community things, and then our grant making has been not only effective, but actually very broad in addressing issues related to Flint and Genesee County.
Philanthropy is really the life's blood of the Community Foundation of Greater Flint. I'm wondering, what is your personal view of philanthropy, about how it can help and the pitfalls? Is there anything you learned from watching the role foundations played, for instance, in getting Detroit out of bankruptcy?
I think there has to be a balance of time, talent, and treasure that's available in community to meet community issues. We could look at it and say that we're going to do 2 and 4 communities and make them better, but I think the best approach is doing with. So as opposed to doing 2 and 4, we have positioned ourselves to do with our community, which requires that we engage community in ways that we never have before. All too often, our philanthropic theories of change or processes of determining what the impact is long before we know what the intervention will be don't work when you're talking about sustaining interventions that matter for community. So I think we're learning a lot. We're a learning organization. The reality is the best-in-class philanthropic organizations have to be learning organizations because the community around us is changing, and our response to supporting and working with that community has to be just as nimble and just as flexible.
So the kinds of lessons that have been seen in Detroit, it should not be a top-down approach when it comes to philanthropic donations.
I think we continue to learn. Detroit learned a lot through their process. New Orleans is learning a lot through disaster response, and Puerto Rico is learning a lot right now. And what we here in Flint are doing is trying to benefit from all of the lived experiences across those spaces. I think that's the way philanthropy as a field will continue to grow. And so I don't think it's an indictment of any community when we say that it was top down at one point and we're learning and growing. I just think that we have to continue to do that in order to meet the needs of the people that we love and care for in our communities.
Isaiah, what assumptions do you hear from people who are from outside of Flint that you'd like to set straight about your city? I guess I'm asking, what don't people from outside of Flint understand about your city and its people?
Flint is an amazing place. We have resilient people who can take any challenge. I mean, if you think about the diversity of issues related to poverty and what it means or what it can mean for a community, resilience is your ability to take a punch but bounce back in ways that you never have before. Is what we're trying to do. And we want to not only do what's best for our community, but if we can, serve as a model for other communities, knowing that poverty isn't unique to Flint and nobody's cornered the market on how you respond. But our most valuable resource is not the philanthropic dollars that exist in this community. It's the people in this community and their resilience.
How will you measure success in your role as president and CEO of the Community Foundation of Greater Flint?
The community that I love, the community that I live in, I work in, I play in, I'm raising my family in, has to be better as a result of the interventions that we're funding, the relationships that we're building, and the work that we're doing in community. If 5, 10 years from now, we can't talk about the interventions that were funded or supported by the Community Foundation making this a better space for my 4-year-old, my 7-year-old, my 7-month-old, then I would say that I failed as a leader of one of the most influential organizations in Genesee County. That's a lot to go to sleep at night with. That's a lot to wake up in the morning with. But I take on that role and I take it very seriously. It's about making this community better for my kids and the friends of my kids and the next generation of people in Flint, Genesee County.
Isaiah Oliver, president and the CEO of the Community Foundation of Greater Flint. Thank you so much for spending time with us, Isaiah.
Thank you.
Coming up, is there a relationship between playing violent video games and engaging in criminal violent behavior? Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A Republican report released last week by the U.S. House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology tells us that social media accounts linked to a Russian troll farm were tweeting and posting about Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac. Here to tell us more is Detroit Free Press reporter Keith Matheny. Welcome back to Stateside, Keith.
Thanks for having me.
How did the House committee uncover the fact that Russian trolls were actively posting about Line 5?
They've been actually working on issues related to this kind of in concert with the whole controversy about the Russians' involvement online in the U.S. presidential election in 2016. As part of that, they asked the real big social media giants like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter to provide them with accounts and postings or tweets that they had confirmed came from this troll farm, if you will, this facility in St. Petersburg, Russia, at which the Russian government apparently directs postings that essentially are Russian propaganda. And those were provided by the social media companies to this committee, and from that the report was generated.
And do we know what some of these tweets and posts had to say about Line 5?
Unfortunately, specifically to Line 5, they did not include any in the report. They did include some examples from other controversial pipeline projects. But as a general matter, they said that they were posting about things. When you think back over the last couple of years, what have been some of the really controversial, divisive issues, and it's sort of Keystone XL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, and Line 5 here locally. Those were the kinds of things that they were chiming in on as part of the ongoing debate here in the United States. They did mention in the report that there were tweets related to Line 5 in which they were directing people to a petition to decommission the pipeline in the Straits. However, later in the report, they also mentioned there were some tweets that were pro-oil and gas, pro-oil development in Texas, for example. So it's almost... The conclusion I reach from it is that they maybe were just trying to stir up chaos, kind of like what they supposedly did in the election.
Certainly by, targeting these controversial energy projects in the U.S., and you're saying kind of taking both sides, it does sound like, stirring that pot as ferociously as they can.
Well, the chairman of the Science, Space, and Technology Committee, Lamar Smith, a Republican from Texas, he's kind of pushing the notion that Russia benefits from stirring up this controversy related to U.S. energy, fossil fuel energy in particular, because that's a big commodity that they sell throughout Europe. And to the extent that they can kind of hold the U.S. down, if you will, that's to their benefit. Now, Democrats and some environmentalists are pushing back on that a little bit, saying, well, wait a minute, we have some very legitimate concerns about our fossil fuel use. Obviously, there are legitimate concerns about the more than six-decade-old pipelines in the Straits of Mackinac. So, again, it's just they're kind of adding on, trying to stir things up, trying to keep us divided.
Keith, is there any sense from the report that they know how many people may have seen or engaged with the Russian troll farm posts?
They did not get into that in this report. However, we know related to some of the Facebook ads that they did related to the election, that something like 126 million people 1/3 of the U.S. population may have saw those posts related on Facebook from 2015 to 2017 related to the election. Not sure if this got that kind of traction or not, but they certainly were involved in a number of different pipelines.
The New York Times reported a couple days back that the State Department was granted $120 million by Congress to address Russian meddling, and it has spent exactly not $1 of that money so far. Did this congressional report indicate any measures that would be taken or should be taken to address this?
Not that I've really seen. Again, the kind of the push of the Republican majority here is, stop letting Russia hold us back from, full-throated fossil fuel development. Obviously, there's going to be some opposition to that from people who think we need to go more of a renewable direction. It certainly raises legitimate questions about to what degree we're going to allow this to go on in our social discourse, and I think some questions need to be answered on it.
Is it at all clear what should happen next based on the information spelled out in this report?
I guess it depends on who decides what they're going to do with it. There seems to be a bit of opposition between what conclusions we should draw here. Again, with the majority, the Republican majority in this committee saying this only shows that we should go full ahead with fossil fuel development, mm-hmm. and others saying it doesn't show that at all. We have, our legitimate concerns on these issues, and we actually shouldn't let this trolling muddle these legitimate concerns we have.
Russian internet trolls meddling in the Straits of Mackinac oil pipeline. That report in the Free Press from Detroit Free Press reporter Keith Matheny. Always great to talk with you, Keith. Thanks.
Thanks very much.
And we reached out to Enbridge, which is a financial supporter of Michigan Radio. Their spokesperson declined to comment. When a young person commits a crime, a very common response is to blame video games, especially violent ones, for this criminal act. The recent mass shooting at a Florida high school was no exception. 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz told police he was the one who killed 17 and wounded many more. And here's President Trump talking about that and the other school shootings.
We have to do something about maybe what they're seeing and how they're seeing it. And also video games. I'm hearing more and more people say the level of violence on video games is really shaping young people's thoughts.
Indeed, President Trump is calling video game industry leaders to the White House for a meeting this Thursday. The focus? Whether violent video games contribute to real-world violence in our country. Western Michigan University criminologist Whitney DeCamp has been researching exactly that question. He is an associate professor of sociology, and he is with us now. Whitney, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, great to be here.
So what prompted you toward looking into this research, whether video games spark violent behavior?
Well, it wasn't something that I was initially planning to study, but maybe about a decade ago, I attended a talk by Professor Ray Paternoster from University of Maryland, and he talked about a particular method for studying things that are the result of a selection bias. And after thinking about it for a while and also reading some news stories about politicians saying that video games were responsible for some violence, I realized that I could use the method that I had heard about to study this phenomenon, and I wanted to try that out, and I managed to find some data sets and gave it a try, and I started down a path that got me to where I am now with several studies under my belt looking at this.
And when you talk about selection bias, explain to us what that means and how you constructed your studies.
Well, selection bias can refer to a lot of things. In this particular case, selection bias refers to the fact that people who play violent video games are probably already different from people who don't, even before they start playing them, because there's a difference. Some people choose to play violent video games, some people don't. Some people choose to play them a lot. Some people only try them out and decide they're not for them. The decision that leads to somebody playing video games a lot versus not is already representative of a personality trait, something where they might be attracted to violence. And it's really important that we control for that, because if we just ask the question, do you play violent video games and did you engage in violence, we might get a misleading correlation, one that is present but doesn't mean that it's causal. It doesn't mean that playing video games caused them to act violently. They were already potentially on that path before video games entered the picture.
Okay, so what did you find? Because the big question is, is there a relationship between playing these violent video games and engaging in criminal violent behavior?
What my research indicates is that for young males, we don't see that relationship there. We see a correlation but not a causal relationship. Once we control for that underlying propensity towards violence, there's really not much of a relationship that survives in terms of a connection between video games and real-life violence. What we do see is factors relating to their home life, to their relationship with parents that matter. Children who have a strong relationship with their parents are a lot less likely to engage in violence. Kids who are in a safe home where they don't see or hear violence, where they're not the victim of violence, they're a lot less likely to engage in violence as well if they're not exposed to violence in real life. And those factors matter a lot more than playing video games or media or anything like that.
Now, we know California tried banning the sale of violent video games to minors, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, they struck down that law and said it was a violation of teens' First Amendment rights. Do we know if there are still states that are trying to enact some kind of a video game ban for minors?
Well, the Supreme Court decision in that regard was very strong. The rationale for striking that down was that essentially you can't take away someone's First Amendment rights unless you have a really compelling reason. And the body of research that exists at that time and since then, really, doesn't show that there is that causal relationship. So there's not enough of a danger to justify taking away someone's First Amendment right on this. So I think a lot of states have backed down from that attempt because it's been very clear that the Supreme Court ruling pretty much just shut down that entire effort to try and make it illegal to sell video games to children. At the same time, there's a couple things I should note. One is that stores are still welcome to restrict who buys video games, and most retail stores do restrict that. It's actually harder for a minor to buy a violent video game than it is for them to buy an R-rated movie, for example, based on some studies that have been done by the FTC using mystery shoppers. There have been some other efforts to try and use legislation to address this issue. A representative in Rhode Island was attempting to pass a tax on video games based on whether or not they have violence. But that, again, would be problematic under the Supreme Court ruling because then you'd essentially be taxing something based on what the Supreme Court has decided is a First Amendment issue. I don't think legislation like that is particularly likely to move forward unless and until we see new evidence that shows there is a link, and I haven't really seen anything like that recently, then I don't think that there's going to be much progress on this front to address it through legislation.
As a criminologist, you try to figure out why someone commits a crime, and that is certainly top of mind in this country after the Parkland, Florida school shooting and other school shootings. What is your sense as to what's happening in the mind of a school shooter?
That's something that's really hard to say because I think a lot of these situations are very unique and really would require an in-depth case study to understand what might be the thought process involved. But some of the things that we can see from general trends along these lines, if we look at the cases and just try and figure out what the common elements are, a lot of times we see people who have a lack of a social bond to society. And that's a criminological term. A social bond is usually expressed through an attachment to your parents or to teachers in school or even to positive peers who aren't engaged in violence. Additionally, we also seem to see a lot of these people who are engaging in shooting tend to be under a good bit of strain. They may be victims of bullying or teasing or just having trouble in school. These are things that we often see as predictors of violence in general. It might be the case that these are also predictors of a willingness to engage in a mass shooting. To my knowledge, there hasn't been a study that has been able to get enough power to look at this issue because, thankfully, despite this being in the news a lot, it's still a fairly rare crime in comparison to a lot of the other violence that's out there. And so I haven't seen any sort of quantitative study that's been able to look at this and really determine whether or not these are common factors. But just anecdotally, based on what I've read, I wouldn't be surprised to see these being some of the contributing factors to the situation.
I'm interested, Whitney DeCamp, in whether you have any thoughts as to why these school shooters are virtually all boys. Now, I will point out in 1979, Brenda Ann Spencer killed her principal and a school janitor, and she wounded 8 students at her school in San Diego. She's the one who purportedly told a local reporter, "I don't like Mondays. This livens up the day." But basically, we're talking about boys when these happen. Any idea why?
Well, that's a good question, and it's something that criminologists have been studying for quite some time. We've known that gender is a very strong predictor of violence for quite some time. It's been considered the strongest predictor in a lot of situations. And the more serious the type of violence that we're talking about, the more likely it is that it's a male rather than a female. There have been a number of studies that have tried to sort this out. speaking in terms of violence in general, not specifically shootings, we've essentially eliminated a lot of biological chemical causes for this difference. What it seems to be is more masculinity in terms of social expectations and upbringing. Boys are a lot more likely to be socialized in a way where they, for whatever reason, are more likely to engage in violence. It may be seen as a masculine trait, and that may discourage young women from becoming involved in this. We've seen over the last 50 or 60 years with the women's liberation movement in the 70s that we started seeing rates of engaging in crime converging between men and women, but it remains true that the more violent the crime, the less likely it is that we're going to see a woman engaged in it. As far as why that goes, I think it goes back to that issue of upbringing and seeing violence as a masculine behavior.
So the research that you've done to this point suggests that video games do not spark violence, but what's the next question you want to look into about video games?
There's a number of different directions that I think we can head from here. I'm continuing to study violence in video games because it is, of course, still a major topic and one that's somewhat controversial. But in addition to that, there's also been some concerns about video game addiction and factors surrounding that. And so that's one of the things that I'm beginning to study and do some analyses with. In a nutshell, people are concerned that some youth are becoming obsessed with video games. There certainly are anecdotal cases where that does seem to be the situation. But one of the questions that I have, is it really video games or is it just hobbies in general? Is there something about video games that makes them unique? I haven't really heard much in the way of a compelling explanation for why video games are different from any other type of media consumption or, for that matter, other types of hobbies. You could become obsessed with anything, really. I think separating out video games and making it seem like they are a greater danger for this is a bit premature at this point.
To that point, how do you think that Thursday meeting at the White House is going to go down between the president and video game industry leaders?
The ESA, which is the organization that represents the video game industry, has made it pretty clear what they're going to do at that meeting, and that is they are going to try and set the record straight. They're going to say that the research studies that are out there don't support that there is a connection between playing violent video games and engaging in real-life violence. We've seen a number of politicians, not just President Trump, but others, make very clear statements that there is a connection, and the ESA would like to use this meeting as an opportunity to set the record straight and clarify that that is not what the research supports.
What do you think a parent should take away from what you're saying today? What should a parent do or not do if they've got a kid who is pretty obsessively playing a video game that has a lot of shooting and violence? What would you tell that parent?
Well, I would tell that parent just the fact that they're concerned about their children and their exposure to violence already tells me they're probably an involved parent and one who has a good relationship with their children and wants to be involved in their daily life. That alone is already going to say that their children are probably at much lower risk for being involved in violence. I would then also say that the research doesn't suggest that playing violent video games is a risk factor for engaging in real-life violence. And in fact, some studies have even shown that it might be the opposite. The fact that they're inside, engaged in a behavior that isn't hurting anyone, is actually making them less likely to be involved in real-life violence. There's a number of positive benefits from playing video games, including higher interest in computer science. Better hand-eye coordination is another classic one, and a number of other positive pro-social outcomes have been observed. I would tell that parent that that doesn't mean that they should absolutely consider violent video games harmless. If a child is very young, for example, exposure to violence might cause them to have nightmares or make them feel like the world is unsafe, regardless of whether or not they are in a safe environment. And so parents should certainly consider whether or not exposure to violence is right for their children. But if they're worried that it's going to cause their children to go out and hurt other people, the research just doesn't support that.
Whitney DeCamp is a criminologist, associate professor of sociology at Western Michigan University, where he directs the Kircher Center for Social Research. Fascinating research, and I want to thank you for taking time to share it with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Joey Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.